Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. This month, crews are cleaning and decontaminating DuPont's neoprene rubber plant in Louisville. Soon the plant will be demolished. For some, it's good riddance to a toxic legacy. For others, an unhappy ending. WFPL's Kristen Espelon reports on the dismantling.
In 1941, America was headed to war. The effort would require massive amounts of raw materials and all manufacturing hands on deck. But there was a shortage of one particularly critical material, rubber. Enough of a shortage that the federal government ordered rubber rationing and commandeered facilities like DuPont's Louisville-based synthetic rubber plant. That plant in West Louisville went on to churn out a synthetic rubber called neoprene for another 67 years. But soon, the plant will come down, brick by brick, pipe by pipe. Bob Singleton manages the plant. He's also overseeing its decontamination. That's the first step of many it will take to get to the point where they can actually demolish the buildings. Workers have almost finished decontaminating and cleaning every pipe and tank.
You see, all the tanks are opened up now. They've been cleaned.
Singleton says another crew will come in later to remove the vintage plant's asbestos. He describes the process as he leads the way through a steel jungle of steaming pipes and gaping tanks. They once held a toxic brew of petrochemicals and minerals. He says workers used a solvent to flush the hazardous chemicals out. What came out was piped into trucks, which carted the liquid off to an incinerator. And then workers flushed everything out again with massive amounts of water.
We use steam as also part of the decontamination. Okay, once the lines are cleared and everything, depending on what's in there, we flush it with steam.
He leads the way up metal stairs into a building full of conveyor belts and more pipes. He says these two have been decontaminated and power washed. The idea is to protect workers who will later dismantle these machines and tanks and pipes and buildings. The idea is also to keep toxic chemicals out of landfills. But during its lifetime, the plant hasn't managed to keep toxic chemicals out of the air. According to the most recent EPA data, this plant put more toxics into Louisville's air than any other registered facility except a local Elginia power plant. That's millions of pounds of chemicals that cause cancer and chemicals that are toxic to the cardiovascular and nervous systems. The EPA's next annual report on toxic chemical releases should show the effects of the plant's closure, but years of past emissions can't be erased.
This is a finishing area over here, and all this is coming down. Lab building is coming down.
Once all the lines are clean, a demolition crew will rip everything out and knock down all the buildings. A few pieces of the plant will be reused in other DuPont facilities, and the bricks will be used to fill in basements before a final layer of gravel is spread over the entire site. But most of it will end up in landfills. And after it's gone, DuPont still has an obligation to the state to clean up any contaminated groundwater. A Division of Waste Management spokesman told me the site will likely never be pristine enough to be used for anything but industry, and developers would still have to test the soil for contaminants before breaking ground. But Singleton says DuPont typically doesn't allow outsiders to develop on its former industrial sites because of liability. Back outside, near the train cars that once streamed in with raw materials, Singleton reflects on the plant's final days.
Well, I hate to see this happening. It's been a part of my life for a number of years, and we've got several people here whose jobs are going away. We've worked here for 40 years, so it's a little bit of a sad event, really.
Although it's likely not a sad event for Louisville's air quality, the city is still home to plenty of other facilities emitting toxic chemicals. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Espeland.
Last week, the University of Louisville unveiled its Nucleus project, which the university hopes will transform a section of downtown into a hub for the life sciences field. But as WFPL's Gabe Bullard reports, the project's success will largely depend on Kentucky's children.
When university officials unveiled the first phase of the Nucleus project this week, its CEO, Vicki Yates Brown, said she's not worried about the $2.3 billion price tag to turn the Haymarket block near Market and Preston Streets into a state-of-the-art research complex.
It is difficult economic times, but we are moving on and moving forward in spite of those difficult economic times.
And the threat of a reduction in state funds to attract scientists to the new facility doesn't concern University President James Ramsey.
It is a very difficult time. The fact that those numbers are in the budget is a positive to us. It says that even in the hardest of financial times, the state understands the importance of Bucks for Brains.
What does concern U of L Executive Vice President of Health Services Larry Cook is the fact that there may not be enough students to fill the new facilities.
Math and science in general have not been as popular in this country as they are in China and India and Western Europe in general.
The Nucleus Project will focus on life sciences, fields like biology and pharmaceutical research. Cook says life sciences studies have recently been on the decline in the U.S., but now cities such as St. Louis and Indianapolis are building their own research parks in anticipation of aging baby boomers using the healthcare system. Nucleus CEO Vicki Yates Brown says in order for Louisville to compete with other communities, the city and state will have to cultivate life science students.
In talking with the folks that are experts in building these research parks, their model is based upon the fact that most of this will come out of our own university and our own community. We'll certainly have to continue to grow our research scientists.
Recruiting talent is a challenge when you just generally underfund your public schools, which Kentucky has been doing for 10 or 15 years now.
Bob Sexton is executive director of the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence, a citizens advocacy group.
Kentucky has a must increase its production at the higher education levels of highly talented scientific people.
He says Kentucky elementary school children perform well in science, but are below the national average in math.
Math is, by national standards, is the subject we're doing the most poorly in.
As Kentucky tries to nurture future researchers and make its facilities competitive with those in other American cities, Sexton says schools in the Commonwealth are going to need more public support.
To do that, we're going to have to invest in our schools, and we're going to have to find ways to improve the way we teach those subjects.
There's also been a recent decline in federal funds from the National Institute of Health. The NIH distributes grants to research institutions, and U of L's Larry Cook says most of the cuts came in the last 4 years.
In the decade prior to that, the NIH budget doubled, and that was a time of very robust growth in health sciences research throughout the country and also at the University of Louisville.
While future presidents and congresses may try to restore NIH funding, Cook says the current financial situation puts more of a burden on Kentucky's researchers.
What that means is we have to be better than the next person at competing for that available money.
And for the multi-billion dollar Nucleus Project to be a success, the research scientists Kentucky grows will have to compete not only for international acclaim, but also for local funding. For WFPL, I'm Gabe Bullard.
This weekend, people said goodbye to a club that has added new voices to the local jazz landscape since 2003. Jazz enthusiasts say this in no way signals the demise of the art form in Louisville. WFPL's Elizabeth Kramer reports.
During a Wednesday night drive across the metropolitan area, I find jazz. The first stop is the Speakeasy in downtown New Albany. In a historic building, a big band plays tunes while couples twirl and bop on the sprawling dance floor under soft light. The next stop is the Jazz Factory in downtown Louisville. Here, a full house listens to a jazz combo made up of students from the University of Louisville School of Music. Even near midnight, there is more jazz at the Germantown's Knock Bar, where a trio called Vamp is playing to a bar full of mostly 20 and 30-year-olds. In all three venues, people tell me they are aware that there will be less live jazz in town after Saturday. That's when the Jazz Factory will close. Ken Shapiro has been fielding calls on his cell and office phone since he and his partners who own the Jazz Factory decided earlier this month to close it. For 5 years, notable jazz musicians, including Wynton Marsalis and pianist Kenny Barron, graced its stage. This week, many of them are calling, as are patrons making reservations for this weekend's shows.
And I know that people are thinking about us, and I feel it. And I'll chant with you, I really will.
Shapiro and his partners had an objective that differed from other local clubs. They wanted to present jazz 5 nights a week, and not as background music. They showcased musicians in a room designed with quality acoustics. Making this venture profitable meant bringing in the community's established jazz fans and cultivating new ones to come on a regular basis. In the end, Ken Shapiro says that didn't happen.
We knew going in that it was uphill, that we were swimming upstream a little bit.
But we really felt like with the programming that we did and our ability to do outreach that we would be able to get there.
There is some fear among people in the jazz community that the Jazz Factory's closing could give others the impression that jazz is dead in Louisville. Mike Tracy is a professor of music and jazz at U of L.
The biggest problem for me is people will perceive something that really isn't there now, that jazz is not a vital art form, and it is. And there are people playing. There are people who want to hear it. It's just that this evidently didn't work the way it was supposed to work for them.
Tracy and Shapiro say making any kind of artistic endeavor profitable today is a hard road, with competition from vast forms of entertainment available to people. It's a factor that 32-year-old saxophonist Jacob Duncan says he sees as a member of two different jazz groups.
Jazz isn't the only thing that's happening. I mean, all the arts are struggling. The club, jazz club, was great to have that.
Duncan and other musicians say the Jazz Factory gave them a new and different place to play and a locale that brought new people out to hear them. As for the future, these jazz musicians and enthusiasts say it will continue to thrive in remaining venues, like the ones I visited this week, and in mainstays, like Sills Lounge and the Seelbach Hotel Bar. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
When we come back, I'll speak with baseball statistics guru Bill James. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Shows like Studio 619 offer local news and perspectives, and that's critical to understanding your community. But it's only possible with your support. Become a member of Public Radio today. Here's how. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Aaron Burr is often remembered as one of America's early villains, if he's remembered at all. Author Nancy Eisenberg is a visiting professor at the University of Louisville, and her book, Aaron Burr, Fallen Founder, paints Burr as a man who was not only crucial to America's independence, but also a pioneer for the country's westward expansion and politics of the 19th century. Eisenberg will discuss her book Tuesday evening at the Filson Historical Society. She recently sat down with Gabe Buller to talk about it and Burr's role in American history.
I read the book a few months ago. My father had loaned it to me, and I studied history in college. And Aaron Burr wasn't really very big in the textbooks for American history. Why is that?
Well, I think what most Americans know about Aaron Burr is that he shot and killed Alexander Hamilton in a duel. They may know that he was tried for treason several years later. And then what's interesting is some of them may be aware of the 19th century legacy created by fiction that he was also known as a great womanizer. But you're right. In general, he's not considered a major player, in part because one of the things I try to do in this book is show that history is written by the winners. And it really matters whether or not you have relatives who survive you after you pass, and that they preserve your papers, that they publish your papers. Someone like John Adams and even Alexander Hamilton had relatives who became historians, who played a major part in fashioning their legacy. And this has sort of hurt Burr because many of his papers were lost, and also because he ended up having two very powerful enemies, Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton. And they also diminished his political significance.
Well, he's seen very much, I think, in history as being more of a villainous character, but he had quite a heroic background through the Revolution.
That's very true. I mean, that's one of the interesting things about Burr. And what I try to do is uncover things that are often ignored about his background, his rise before he became vice president. But in the Revolutionary War, he was very common. He had gone to Princeton. It was called the College of New Jersey, where his father, before he had died, had been the first president of the college. And the majority of students at Princeton ended up heading off to Boston, joining the Continental Army, or joining the New Jersey Militia. Princeton was very much a pro-patriot college, and there was an intense enthusiasm about supporting the revolutionary effort. And Burr was one of these individuals. But he also distinguished himself because he ended up being part of this amazing invasion of Canada. This is sort of an aspect of American history very few people know about. It was really the first preemptive strike. Essentially, we were going to invade Canada and convince them to join us in battling against Great Britain and freeing themselves, too, from colonial oppression. Well, it didn't turn out that way. But Burr was involved with this expedition. They traveled hundreds of miles through the Maine wilderness, and he ended up being recognized by General Robert Montgomery, who sort of saw his potential. And when there was this fateful attempt to try to make the assault on Quebec, Burr was part of the lead of the attack group. Robert Montgomery was shot dead and killed. So were many of the people surrounding Burr. He was one of the few survivors, and he ended up being turned into a hero. This was one of the greatest early heroic moments of the war. And many of his close friends from Princeton were impressed by his heroism. And one of his fellow students even wrote an epic poem about it.
And that reputation really lasted him. He was vice president under Thomas Jefferson, but that's at a time where he wasn't Thomas Jefferson's running mate. He had tied him for electoral votes in the general election, correct?
Right. I mean, one of the things about Burr that I try to emphasize is we have to understand why he ended up being Jefferson's running mate. One of the problems is most people just look at Burr during the election, or they tend to just focus on the duel, or some people, they're just separate studies that talk about the issue of the filibuster or conspiracy in the West. But Burr's rise, his ability to sort of survive the Byzantine world of New York politics, where there were powerful families fighting among each other, really put him in position to end up being selected to be senator from New York. That's when he first made his connections with Jefferson and Madison and Monroe, and his political connections. You know, he knew Madison when they were at college together at Princeton, but he sort of was able to form important relationships with Jefferson, who would be the future leader of the Republican Party. But Burr was pivotal because he was a key political player from a northern state. And what we tend to forget about Jefferson's party, the Democratic Republican Party, is that it was a party of the South. And for Jefferson to win the election, he had to at least secure one state from the north, Pennsylvania or New York. And it ended up being New York, which Burr ended up putting on Jefferson's side during the election. But you're right, what ended up happening, because we didn't have the rule which said that candidates from a specific party ran as a joint ticket, and the Electoral College was based on people voting individually for all the candidates, Burr and Jefferson ended up having the same number of votes. This was an unanticipated, an unprepared for situation. And it proves to be really crucial to Burr's career. I mean, winning this election, becoming vice president, is the high point of Burr's career. But what happens is this, as we know, when there are electoral ties in presidential races, this created a great deal of fear. Washington was really small at that time. Most politicians are living together in boarding houses. They're sort of spreading rumors about the fact that people are secretly making deals behind the scene. You know, is Jefferson going to end up securing the election, or Burr? Because what happens when there is a tie, it's thrown into the House of Representatives. And it's a sort of complicated process because the members don't vote as individuals. They vote as sort of bloc states. So there was a lot of jockeying, but essentially, the biggest problem that Burr and Jefferson faced at this moment is the Federalists still had the power edge. This is the opposition party, the party of Washington, Hamilton, and Adams. And they were very interested in supporting Burr, mainly because they thought, well, this would really annoy Jefferson. And there were some who believed, well, we might be able to manipulate Burr better than Jefferson. Jefferson's more dangerous ideologically than Burr. Burr was always seen as a kind of pragmatic style of politician. So there are multiple solutions that are thrown up. I mean, there's even discussions of maybe making the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, somehow they could manipulate the delay putting off the vote, and suddenly no one knew who was going to end up being president.
So how did Jefferson become the president then?
Well, eventually, even though it took a good deal of time, numerous votes, there was actually some negotiation behind the scenes where it was finally decided that the Federalists, who had either been sort of undermining Jefferson getting enough, you had to have like a certain number of these voting bloc states for Jefferson to win the office, they finally decided that they wouldn't stand in the way, or they wouldn't vote, or they would end up supporting Jefferson. And essentially, they decided to do this for a variety of reasons. I mean, one of the key players in all of this, a man by the name of Bayard from Delaware, essentially said, well, there's no reason for us to keep supporting Burr. He's made it quite clear that if he comes into office, he's not going to, work with us or be our puppet. Essentially, he's going to be just as much of Democratic-Republican candidate as Jefferson would be. And they finally sort of, there were some promises made to a friend that he'd keep his job, maybe some of the programs the Federalists had put in place Jefferson wouldn't tamper with. And that's essentially how this thing resolved. But it essentially ended up being fodder for Burr's enemies back in his state. They would start spreading the rumor that Burr had tried to steal the election, that he had been a, quote, traitor to his party. And this emerged basically, a year later as a way to try to get him out of the way as a power broker in the party within his state and to sort of replace him with the Clinton faction. This is not the Clintons as we know them today. this is the old Clintons, George and DeWitt Clinton, DeWitt Clinton, who sort of helped build the Erie Canal. They were rivals of Burr's faction, even though they're in the same party. And they were hoping to sort of push Burr out of the way, and they could do this by spreading this rumor that he had tried to steal the election.
So how did he go from nearly becoming the third president to, I don't want to say he's more of a footnote, but just this, he's become a lesser historical figure. So how did that happen?
Well, I think there are a variety of reasons. I hate to say it, but, Americans, often we lose a lot of our history. And one of the things I also try to do in this book is that even though it's a biography, people actually do not become important historical figures on their own. They need supporters. They need allies. There are sort of fascinating people who end up supporting Burr that you need to know about, to know his story. But what happened to him, and I also like to say that I think Burr would have made a very good president. He was extremely smart, and I think the programs he would have supported would have been beneficial. But what happened is that we could imagine this in today's politics. I mean, if you are sort of end up being exiled by your own party, where are you going to go? And this is essentially what happened to Burr. He was forced out of the vice presidency. He's replaced with George Clinton, who becomes Jefferson's second vice president. He ends up returning to New York. And he could have stayed in New York, but, of course, the minor matter of the duel with Hamilton created even further problems for him.
I think that's one of the most famous things, or if not what everyone knows him for. There's the famous milk commercial.
Right.
How did he come to duel Hamilton?
Well, one of the things you have to understand about dueling is that it was quite common. It started during the Revolutionary War. This was a practice that men in the British military and the French military engaged into because there was a great concern about honor. and honor the honor code operated on the principle that if someone insulted you, a member of your family, undermined or hurt your reputation, you had to try to recover your reputation. And the way, there were sort of several ways to resolve these kinds of disputes. Either you would go to the individual and ask them to make a public apology. They could apologize. The issue would be settled. But if the person refused to apologize, then it would move to the next step, where there would be an exchange of letters. And then finally, if it could not be resolved in a peaceful fashion, the two men would agree to meet on the field of honor. And then there would be rules laid out in terms of how they would engage in a duel. And duels took a variety of form. There were duels in Europe. Sometimes they engaged with swords. By this time, it is pistols. And the basic premise was that you would stand a number of paces apart. It could be agreed whether you'd shoot at once or one person would shoot first. But this was like a test of manhood. It was a test to prove that you were willing to die in the name of protecting your reputation. A lot of duels became mere formalities. People would go to the dueling ground, shoot in the air, or even in Burr's case, given the evidence of where we know the bullet ended up hitting Hamilton, another practice, and this had happened to a friend of Burr's who had had a duel with DeWitt Clinton, essentially received four bullets in the leg. It was another problem. It was another strategy to maybe graze the person with the bullet. Now, this all seems crazy to us. We can't imagine two such prominent people willing to die because they had been insulted by gossip. But the important thing we have to remember is that this pattern of protecting one's reputation was something that most politicians who had been in the military, and that's an important distinction. Jefferson, John Adams never dueled because they didn't come out of this military culture. But it ended up being incorporated into the early political culture. And as I highlight, there were differences between how Hamilton and Burr thought about honor. Essentially, Hamilton had been involved in 11 affairs of honor, and that essentially meant he had either went to someone charging them with insulting him and beginning the process of an affair of honor, or someone else had insulted him. Burr had been involved in really just two, with two people. and one was Hamilton, and the other was Hamilton's brother-in-law, and that was because his brother-in-law had spread gossip that Hamilton had given him about Burr. And Burr really, you know, Hamilton's idea of duel was about you had to protect your reputation at all costs. Where Burr felt that the duel and the process itself had to adhere to certain rules of decorum. And this is, you know, this is sort of one of the things we have to understand about dueling, that different people had different ideas.
Who did he drive in? How many runs of his runs did he drive in with singles? How many with doubles? It's just a simple question, but nobody knows the answer. How many of his hits came on line drives? How many on fly balls? How many on ground balls? How many hits did he have to left field, the center field, the right field? It's not theory or speculation. It's just basic questions. And, you know, we were able to identify 1,000 or more basic questions like that to which we didn't have the answers. And then we tried to go into the records and find the answers to them.
Are fantasy players using your information quite a bit?
I would suppose they are. I've never written specifically to fantasy players, and don't now, but I suppose they. I'm sure they use the book. They use everything.
Now, do you offer predictions for like World Series winners or who's going to do well for a particular season?
No, there's no such predictions in the book.
Do you have a favorite team? Are the Red Sox your team?
Well, I work for the Red Sox, so yes, and the Red Sox are really easy to root for. Honestly, they're a lot of fun, and I'm a Red Sox fan.
We have quite a connection with the Red Sox here in Louisville. Years ago, Louisville was the Red Sox farm team before they moving to Pawtucket, so we still have a connection with them.
Yeah, it's been a few years. Of course, everybody remembers Pee Wee Reese played for Louisville, and then was sold to the Dodgers before he came to the majors.
That's right, yeah. Well, the name of the book, The Bill James Gold Mine, I assume it's available everywhere?
It is available everywhere.
Okay, Bill, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
When we come back, Gabe Buller talks to author Nancy Eisenberg. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. It's our spring membership drive at Louisville Public Media, the time when we ask you to become part of our family and make great programs like Studio 619 possible. Here's how.
Is of exactly how the process should be carried out, or exactly, you know, how they viewed the significance of honor. What was really the measure of honor? For Burr, it was about sincerity. For Hamilton, it was about saving his public face, and that was the most important thing.
That was Gabe Buller talking with Nancy Eisenberg. Her book, Aaron Burr, Fallen Founder, is a finalist for an L.A. Times Kirsch Book Award for biography. She'll speak at the Filson Historical Society Tuesday evening at 6. That's it for this week's Studio 619, but there's still time for you to take that next step and become a member of Public Radio. It's our spring membership drive, and we're looking for your commitment to continue great programs like Studio 619 on WFPL. Here's how to become a member of Public Radio today.